Thank you very much, Stan. Following Stan Evans is like moving from the sublime to the ridiculous. Or vice versa, he adds. I was hoping you'd say that. He's well known for his modesty. One time, Winston Churchill said there are three very difficult things for a man to do. One is to kiss a woman who's leaning away from him. The other is to climb over a fence that is leaning toward him. And the third one is to give an effective after-dinner speech. Well, I'm not going to try. I don't believe in doing the impossible like the lady who said I'd give my right arm to be ambidextrous. Finally, a few of them are getting it. Yes, sir. This evening, I'd like very briefly to cite a few facts about the Prestige Press and foreign policy. And perhaps end, as Stan suggested, with a word or two about the saga of last year. By the Prestige Press, I mean the Seven Sisters, the New York Times, Washington Post, the three TV networks, Time and Newsweek. The New York Times leads the pack. As one executive, news executive, put it, the Times is our Bible. It tells us what is likely to be considered important by the other media, he might have added, and how to think about it. We've heard a great deal in the last decade about the Eastern liberal syndrome and the affinity of the Prestige Press for the adversary culture. The Seven Sisters are similar, but they are neither identical nor consistent. Now, I'm talking tonight mainly about news, not news interpretation, and must acknowledge that the Prestige Press does some things well. Irving Kristol once said, what they do best is reporting sports and obituaries. They usually get the score right and put the right man in the grave. But foreign policy reporting is a different thing. It's a very seriously mixed bag. We who live in an information-saturated society recognize they must and do sort out events for us. The British-Argentine dispute has been reported reasonably well, but the Salvadorian crisis, which has been temporarily erased from their consciousness and ours, has been reported very poorly. Now I come to my thesis. Where the Prestige Press falls down conspicuously, perhaps tragically, is reporting the larger events and issues of freedom. This is especially true where the interests of the United States and the Soviet Union are in conflict, and more broadly, where totalitarianism threatens free or partially free societies. Let me give some illustrations drawn from content analysis projects in which I have been involved. I'm going to pass by the lopsided and irresponsible reporting of much of the American press during the latter years of the Vietnam War, but I would like to recommend a book called The Prestige Press and the Christmas Bombing, 1972, Images and Realities in Vietnam by Ambassador Martin Hertz and published by our center. Now let me move to these case studies briefly and skim off some of the facts. I made a study of CBS Evening News on national defense and foreign policy reporting a decade ago, 1972-73. During those 2 years, this is what the Evening News, with its 196 hours of reporting per year, said to the American people about the consequential issues of the world crisis and American responsibility. This was during the time of the beginning of the massive Soviet military buildup under the cloak of detente, its great leap forward in strategic weapons, manpower, research, development, and cost. During those 2 years, CBS gave exactly 60 seconds to the most important military fact of our time, a direct comparison of U.S. and Soviet military strength. In contrast, it gave 1 minute and 50 seconds to missing tableware in Pentagon cafeterias. The show carried almost no information of growing Soviet military might in missiles, aircraft, warships. There was no direct reference to a new 4,500-mile submarine missile, the annual production of 5 to 9 nuclear submarines, a new generation of ICBMs capable of destroying U.S. Minutemen, and of carrying multiple warheads. There was no reference to a system capable of destroying U.S. reconnaissance satellites, or a new supersonic strategic bomber, or the launching of the first Russian aircraft carrier, and the fact that military spending was 4 times larger than what Moscow acknowledged. This highly selective reporting had the effect of downplaying the Soviet threat. Consequently, the American people were hardly prepared for the subsequent debate over the inadequacies of U.S. military power. While minimizing or ignoring the growing Soviet threat, the Walter Cronkite Show simultaneously presented an overwhelmingly negative picture of U.S. military developments. Now, of course, it's essential in a free society with a free press to criticize all institutions, including the military, but the steady drumbeat of negative reporting with virtually no reference to the positive role of the armed forces can erode and did erode public confidence in an institution essential to our survival. During those 2 years, of all military reporting, 66% cast the armed forces in an unfavorable light, 21% in a neutral light, and only 13% favorable. The composite picture that emerged was a U.S. military establishment that fought a bloody, unjust, and racist war in Vietnam, where our forces committed atrocities and engaged in illegal bombing. The attentive viewer would have looked almost in vain for positive stories, and he would have found 3 during that 2-year period. The Navy taught a whale to retrieve objects from deep water. 2, some Air Force doctors found a new way to perform kidney operations. And 3, a Marine camp in California showed an interest in the environment. During this period, the Cronkite Show gave 16 times as much space to dovish views on national defense as it did to hawkish ones. In 1972, for example, we found only 1 news item calling for increased military expenditures and 13 for reduced. The same year, CBS reported 91 items asserting that detente was desirable and only 4 that it was risky. Why did the Cronkite Show do this? I don't know. But in response to a question about the book that emerged from the study, Cronkite said in November 1974, quote, "There are always groups in Washington expressing views of alarm over the state of our defenses. We don't carry those stories. The story is that there are those who want to cut defense spending." Selective reporting, and I dare say selective morality, was also manifest in covering the massive bloodbath in Cambodia that followed the communist takeover in April 75. Independent and reliable sources estimate that as a direct result of the communist regime's purification policies, over 1 million innocent Cambodians, men, women, and children, died, often in an agonizing way. In relative population terms, this is a greater atrocity than either Hitler's concentration camps or Stalin's gulag. How did the Prestige report this atrocity? Each of the 3 TV network evening news shows gave an average of 20 seconds per month to the bloodbath during these 20 months. The newspapers did a little better. Of the 63 stories I examined that carried even a slight reference to the bloodbath or alleged atrocities, 30 were in the New York Times, 17 in the Post, and 12 in the Christian Science Monitor. As far as I can tell, the bloodbath story hit the front page only once, and it was in the Post on February 2nd, 1976. And to its credit, the Post in April 77 published what purported to be the first picture of the Cambodian atrocities. In sharp contrast, to the great silence on perhaps the greatest per capita genocide of our time, the Prestige Press gave more coverage to the moral outrage expressed by critics of the Spanish government in 1975 for executing five terrorists convicted of murdering policemen. Moving on from the attack on the military, the zealots of the press turned their attention to the CIA and the FBI. It was Seymour Hersh of the New York Times leading the crusade. The screaming front lines were as inaccurate as his reporting and caused Hanson Baldwin to say, these stories were exaggerated, inaccurate, or irresponsible. I think you recall that sad period. One could also point to the way the press handled the Glomar Explorer incident, the raising of a portion of a Soviet submarine in the Pacific, and the revealing of classified information, which made it impossible for the CIA to go back after the key parts of that submarine, the Pentagon Papers cases. Here the press, unelected by anyone, arrogated to itself the prerogatives of the elected representatives of the people. Neither the Constitution nor the Bill of Rights gives the press the right to determine what documents should be classified or declassified. One more quick case study, which I did, of how the three networks handled the CIA and the KGB during a period of intensive media interest in foreign intelligence. I refer to the January 1974 through October 1978 period, 5 years less 2 months. The stark findings of the three network programs speak for themselves. Of all the news on foreign intelligence, less than 5% was devoted to Soviet bloc agencies and more than 95% to the CIA. From the network's perspective, the CIA appeared to be acting as in a political and moral vacuum, devoid of threats and adversaries, like some villainous Don Quixote tilting at vaporous windmills. The highly distorted picture of the CIA emerged because of the emphasis on negative stories. Only 13.9% of the news items measured in minutes reflected favorably on the CIA. 68.2% reflected unfavorably, and the rest were neutral. There were five recurring themes in the stories. The CIA engages in immoral or illegal activities. It is not sufficiently accountable. It engages in questionable activities. It is corrupt and untrustworthy, and it is incompetent or inefficient. Now, here are some conclusions I draw from these studies and from common sense observation. First, the Prestige Press has failed to give the American people a clear picture of the present and growing external threat and to the larger cause of freedom. It has downplayed the massive Soviet military buildup. It understated the threat of freedom in Southeast Asia. It discounted the domino theory, which already has been vindicated by history. It virtually ignored the Cambodian bloodbath while it was happening, and only belatedly has it given attention to the atrocities of communist Vietnam and the inhumanity of Yellow Rain. By underreporting and misreporting the totalitarian challenge, the Prestige Press failed to prepare the American people for the agonizing decisions we now confront. Fortunately, fortunately, there was and is an alternative press to which millions of Americans turn for a different view of the world. This alternative press can be symbolized by the Reader's Digest. A faithful readers of the Digest would have been far better prepared to cope with the protracted crisis and American responsibility than one who relied only on the New York Times or evening TV news. He would have known more about the Soviet buildup, the worldwide activities of the KGB, the genocide in Cambodia, and the declining U.S. military strength relative to that of our major adversary. This little uplift journal, as it is called by its detractors, is sneered at by the New York Times and the New Yorker in their lofty sophistication. Yet it has been more realistic and more compassionate in its reporting of the struggle between freedom and tyranny than the titans of the prestige press. The David of Pleasantville has demonstrated greater moral understanding and political wisdom than the Goliaths of Gotham. The misreporting of the world crisis by the prestige press reveals a deeper flaw, a persistent failure to distinguish between totalitarian regimes and authoritarian regimes. I need not elaborate on that point. A closely related factor is the utopian infatuation with change, especially revolutionary change, often found in the prestige press. Both through editorials and slanted reporting, many newsmen have shown greater sympathy for the Marxist revolutionaries in El Salvador than for the central government. This was predictable, given their position on Castro's Cuba. Commenting on the Cambodian bloodbath, the Wall Street Journal sought to explain the weak outcry from the usual wellsprings of moral outrage. It suggested a partial answer. The frequent partnership of moral outrage and revolutionary zeal. Continuing the quote, the crimes of the Khmer Rouge, even though they dwarf other state crimes of our time, have attracted less attention because they were inflicted in the name of revolution. And finally, it is impossible to read the prestige press without a growing consciousness that some of its reporters regard the United States as the chief obstacle to reform and progress in the world. America is the enemy. We are on the wrong side in the inevitable revolution that is sweeping the world. How else can we account for the stream of adjectives questioning what American officials say in news reports about Central America, for example, and the absence of such reservations in reporting what the revolutionaries and their supporters say? Now, this is not the place to examine why the new class, including the prestige journalists, think and act as they do. I'll leave that to the psychologists and others. But this is the place to express and acknowledge the growing alternative organizations and counterforces in our society, within the media, the academy, and the public policy community. The Philadelphia Society is such a force, and I'm proud to be a part of it. Now, Stan, just a few minutes on the ordeal and the role of the prestige press. Last year, when my nomination was announced, more than a dozen organizations actively opposed it from the outset, primarily because they disagreed fundamentally with the Reagan foreign policy as they understood it, and with my strong support for a vigorous foreign policy undergirded by intelligence and military capabilities. Most of these groups had been radical critics of our foreign policy for 10 or 15 years, often taking positions favoring the interests or claims of the Soviet Union over those of the United States. These groups included clergy and laity concerned, the Pro-Castro Council for Hemispheric Affairs, the Coalition for a New Foreign and Defense Policy, the Nestle Boycott People, and the National Council of Churches, the latter two being particularly incensed because I had told the truth about them. Within days after the nomination, these organizations and others orchestrated a major campaign against me and the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Their so-called fact sheets floated no fewer than 20 outright falsehoods. This was done by innuendo, a quotation out of context, and outright fabrication. The fact sheets were promptly taken to friendly sources in the prestige media, including the New York Times and the Washington Post especially, and CBS News, but they were also taken to friendly sources in Time and Newsweek. And the crusade was on. And as Churchill said, a lie can get halfway around the world before truth puts on its boots. I was accused of a lack of compassion, the accusation that hurt me most, and a fondness for authoritarian regimes. This coming from people who had distinguished themselves by pouncing on the minor sins of our friends and by largely overlooking or apologizing for the major sins of our adversaries. These groups also sought out their friendly contacts on Capitol Hill, particularly in the staffs of members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. As a result, the two background papers on me for circulation to committee members for their consideration, prepared by Senator Percy's staff with the help of the Library of Congress, read like the brief of a prosecuting attorney against a vicious criminal. They had no bearing, no relationship to a reasonable resume of a presidential nominee. The net result of this was an unholy alliance, including the left liberal organizations, their friends in the media, and their friends on Capitol Hill, which effectively projected a grotesque caricature of who I was and where I stood. Yet in spite of this projection, ordinary people I meet in the street and airports today come up and seem to know where I really stand. This is remarkable. This shows that the prestige press has less influence among the ordinary people than it does in Washington or New York. One senator on the committee told me candidly that he would like to support me, but he was not voting on me or where I stood, but rather on the image of me projected in the press. Thus, the press succeeded in reinforcing and elaborating for the American people and the entire world a major, what some people call a major character assassination attempt of an innocent American. But it did not succeed. I survived, and you ought to see me now. Thank you.